All right, I have a bunch of really good questions. I'm not going to get to them all, and I'm also going to do my best to try to answer them, if I can, to group them together if possible. And if I don't get to your question, maybe it will appear in a future scroll article or in a sermon. So my first question that I'm going to answer is, what is your favorite animal, bird, or sea creature? I am a dog person, so I know a couple weeks ago I had you stand up if you were a dog person or a cat person or that kind of thing. So I'm going to go with dogs are my favorite, particularly big dopey dogs like the one I have at home. He's a lab, and he thinks he's little. He wants to get in my lap. He's sweet. The next one is, what is the meaning of life, or what is your favorite pizza? This one was signed, and I know it's by a kid who has since gone to RE, but you can tell him what the answer is, because he's your kid. So I think the meaning of life is not something that we have a common answer to. It's something that we create. We don't find our meaning or find our purpose. You know, we use that language sometimes. You know, if I can only find my purpose. And I think instead we create it. We create meaning out of life. And there's another question in here a little later that will touch on that as well. But that means it's a co-creative process. We're going to... there goes my kid. It's a co-creative process. It means we're working together on it. And I think it's so much easier to make meaning in life in community. It's much harder to do that alone. My favorite pizza is sausage, mushroom, and pineapple. I like a little sweet. This one says, are there a lot or a little bad guys in the world? I think that also comes from a child, but I think children ask us some of the best questions. And I would say a little. But I would also challenge the idea of bad guys or bad people. The second word in Unitarian Universalist is universalist, which is a belief system that was that God loved everyone so much that God wouldn't create a hell. There wasn't even a place called hell. This idea that God loved us because God saw in us goodness and not sin and evil and bad. And so what that means is that we're not born as babies with sin in us or original sin. We're born as babies with goodness in us. And for me, that's been absolutely my experience of babies. And that over time, we might learn things about the world that make us make choices that hurt people. And we all do it, whether we're hurting people in small ways or large ways. But that doesn't make the person bad. It makes their actions something that are harmful. And so, yeah, some people do make choices that really hurt people. But I think more people make choices that help people. And far more people. It's just that when that one person hurts someone, it often affects a lot of people. And so sometimes when we see stories on the news about bad things happening, I always follow Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers' advice to look for the helpers, because there's a lot more of those people helping. And if you're talking to your children at home or your grandchildren or nieces or nephews or friends about some of the bad things they see or hear about in the news, I really encourage you to acknowledge the bad thing, use honesty, but then also transition to the helpers to help them reclaim a sense of safety in the world. Reverend Christina, what has been the biggest surprise to you about the fellowship? So, as many of you know, I am just finishing up. I've started my second year here. August 1st was my anniversary. Woo! So I've now been around long enough to know the system and know what's going on and be surprised by a few things. And when I interviewed, I was well aware that this is one of the largest UU congregations in the country. And what comes along with being a large congregation are certain qualities or certain characteristics that usually come over the course of a very long growth. structures have to be changed in order to accommodate having more and more and more people. The surprise to me, and it wasn't a huge surprise, I think I had an idea coming in, but sort of living into it this year, is the way are the ways in which this fellowship grew so quickly from when calling Roger Birchhausen as your first settled minister to when he left 3 years ago, that the growth was exponential. Went from about 100 members to 700 members in 25 years, which just doesn't happen in most Unitarian Universalist congregations, or any congregation for that matter. And what happened along with that growth was that some of those structures that kind of hold the whole thing together, aside from personalities and individual people, didn't get built. And because those people have been here the whole time, usually it takes 200 years for that kind of growth to happen, and so people are here and then they leave or they pass away, and the structures have to be built. Here, there are people in this sanctuary who remember having to turn the heat on in the old building on Superior Street so that it would be warm in the morning. They'd come over after Saturday Night Live and turn on the heat. And so I don't mean that as a criticism, it's just a fact, and it's been kind of a surprise. Like, whoa, that's, and in some ways it's really incredible that the growth managed to happen anyway, despite some of those structures. But as people are going to get older and move away and pass away, we can't rely on those personalities, and we have to have structures in place that keep this place strong for the future, for the next people who come through the doors. And what happens in small congregations is everyone knows everyone, and so someone who walks in the door says, I want to get something done, and everyone says, oh, just talk to Joey, and they do, and it's great. Some of that kind of still happens here, but we have 700 people, so that's just too many people for new people to kind of keep track of. So we're trying to keep the small feel, small groups, small classes, things like that, but also allow the growth to happen so that more and more and more people can come in and be welcomed into this place. So if you get an answer from me like, well, that's not our process anymore, that's what that's about. I'm not trying to be a downer. I'm trying to actually strengthen this, some of these things that grew, that haven't grown along with us. I hope that makes sense. How do Unitarian Universalists discuss dogma and creed? So Unitarian Universalism used to be two separate Christian denominations. It would be like if the Lutherans and the Methodists decided to get together and make a new thing. The Unitarians and the Universalists were both Christian denominations, but over a couple hundred years of their history, they'd kind of experimented or tried out lots of different types of theologies, and they decided when they got together in 1961 that they weren't going to be explicitly Christian anymore. So they decided to let that part of their history, to set that part of their history down, and create something totally new. And so they created what they called a non-creedal faith. So that's actually part of our definition. We are non-creedal, which means we don't have a creed. We don't have a set statement of beliefs that says you have to believe this in order to be part of Unitarian Universalism. We say things when we light our chalice or we extinguish our chalice, but those are not creeds. They're not tests of belief. We believe that what happens in your mind, what you believe in your own mind, in your own heart about the world, about God, about the afterlife, is up to you. I always say that's none of my business. Except insofar as those beliefs come out in your life, how you live your life. In that case, it is my business as your minister, because I believe that your actions are far more important than what you believe in your mind. Now, you don't just act willy-nilly. We act based on our beliefs. And so what I say is, as long as your beliefs are helpful, hopeful, loving, don't hurt anyone, aren't exclusive, great. They're good beliefs. I call myself a belief pragmatist. As long as they help you, as long as they're useful. But if your beliefs are making you afraid, or they're making you harm yourself or other people, or they're making you feel like we should separate ourselves, then I would challenge you to reconsider your beliefs so that your actions in the world can be helpful to the world. So that's how we speak about creed and dogma, and we often say things like deeds, not creeds. That's like the shorthand, because we believe your actions are more important than your beliefs. The UU guidelines or principles hint about love, but do not make that explicit. Meanwhile, the Philippine UUs have an eighth guideline: there is a God, and God is love. Should we not add a guideline like we believe love is the best foundation for human relationships? I think that's a really interesting question. Great idea. I have a couple thoughts on that. One is that we have our seven principles, which are kind of the guidelines of how we agree to be together. And those can be found at the front of your hymnal if you're curious about our principles, or online. But we also have something that doesn't get much airplay. We don't talk about them as much, but we're going to be talking about them a lot more. And they're called our six sources of inspiration. So we have seven principles, which are the actions, the way you live in the world, and the six sources are the source of that action or the source of that belief. And so I often do this little quiz. So if you were a devout Southern Baptist Christian and you were seeking inspiration, you might look in a particular book for that inspiration. What book would you look in? The Bible. If you were a Muslim, a devout Muslim, what book might you look in? The Quran, right? If you were a pagan, a neo-pagan, someone who worships the seasons and cycles of nature, where might you look for inspiration? Nature, outdoors. You might sit at the foot of a tree or be look at the moon. There are lots of sources of inspiration, but as Unitarian Universalists, we acknowledge six of them. And they are, let's see if I can do this, friends. They are personal experience. We believe that's a source, your own experiences. Prophetic people, the people who speak truth to power. So those might be some of the prophets of old, Jesus, Muhammad. They might be Gandhi or Mother Teresa or Harvey Milk, or, you know, there's all kinds of prophets in the world. That's our second source. The third is the religions of the world, world religions. I always say if a million people believe it, it can't be all bad. So seeking wisdom and truth in the world's religions can be a source of inspiration. Jewish and Christian teachings is a separate source because of our origination out of Jewish and Christian theology. That's why it's separate. And nature is a source, earth-centered spirituality. And then our last source is humanist teachings and science, that we aren't divorced from humanism and science. So the one about Jewish and Christian teachings does say that the particular teaching that we want to focus on is loving our neighbors as ourselves. And so we do explicitly make that explicit in our sources, but it would be really interesting to see how that would play out if it was in our principles. My challenge with making it part of our principles is love is one of those squishy words, and we have this campaign that Unitarian Universalists do called Side with Love. So if we're fighting for immigration rights or marriage equality or any number of social justice causes, we say we are on the side of love. But I think everybody would say that. No one says, I'm not with love. I don't like love. How we define love might be different. And so, for example, someone who, when I was a young child, I told this story in a sermon early in the year. You might remember it. I was maybe eight. I went to church with a friend, a Baptist church, and the youth pastor tried to baptize me. He really, really wanted me to be baptized. He was afraid for my soul. And I kept saying, isn't baptism important? Shouldn't my parents be here? I was like 8 years old. I think how, as an adult, how I look at that experience, I feel like it was wrong. I feel like it was a power differential that should never have been allowed to happen, an adult man and an 8-year-old girl. all kinds of things weren't right in that scenario. And for me, he was operating out of fear. He was afraid for my soul. But he would not have said that. He would have said, I love this child who has entered the doors of my congregation, and I don't want them to go to hell. I did it out of love. And so I challenge the idea of saying, like, I don't even love the Side with Love campaign, particularly for that reason, because I think we all would say that. And so I think it's a great way to check in with ourselves. Am I doing this out of love, or, you know, what am I doing? But I think it's a little too squishy. That's my personal opinion on it. Do you think suffering is necessary for spiritual growth and deepening? And what about the same question for love relationships? Do you think suffering is necessary? No. That's the answer. absolutely not. It is not necessary. This idea that God is going to give you, not going to give you more than you can handle, or that suffering makes us stronger, I think is BS. I do believe that out of suffering we can make meaning. When we suffer, we can explore that, we can learn from it, we can find good in it, we can grow and become stronger, certainly, but that is not the case for everyone. And the idea that some God would hand incredible suffering, often incredible suffering, to innocent people to teach them something seems just cruel and heartless to me. I refuse that theology. I think it's victim blaming and unfair. And the same is true because that theology leads to tolerance of abuse in the church, tolerance of abuse in relationships, and I definitely do not think that love involves suffering. Certainly, disagreements, challenges, you do grow out of that kind of stuff. But when we use the word suffering, we're talking about pain. And pain does happen in life. It happens in the world. It happens in all of our lives. And we can make meaning out of that. But it is not a requisite. It's not a prerequisite for growth. If you have anyone in your lives who are trying to tell you that, I want to talk to you, and let's have a conversation about what love is. And lastly, my last question I'm going to get to here is: does God exist without human beings? A great question. So last week, Reverend Michael Dowd was here, and he spoke about his spelling of the word God with G-O-D-D-E, which is a sort of a feminist reclaiming of the word God, as well as a pagan reclaiming of the word God. It's sort of gender neutral. And Michael defined God as reality, as ultimate reality. The universe, the cosmos, the earth, that all that is. And when I use the word God, that's how I use the word too. I believe that that the cosmos is so big, we can't even wrap our mortal minds around it. We try, and scientists are working really hard to define it all, but we can't. And so we try to come up with words that make it feel really big and really important. And so sometimes we use words like God. Now, I personally, remember what I said about beliefs? We can each have our own beliefs. My personal belief in my own mind is that that God, that thing that is above and beyond and bigger than all of us and connects us all and is within all of us, is not an independent personal thinking thing that helps you find parking spaces or win Super Bowls. That's my belief. So in that belief system, I would say God does exist without human beings. When we go extinct, it'll still be here. But the fact that we have become conscious of it, and we study it, and we are seeking to understand it, means that God, or the reality of all that is, became conscious in us. So it isn't conscious without us. we are the consciousness of God, or all that is. And there's a great story, you might know this one, that says, so someone's in a boat, they're in a boat, and the boat has a hole in it, and they're sinking. And they start praying to God, please God, save me, please God, save me. And so then someone comes by on a boat and says, hey, looks like you got some trouble here. Do you want to get in my boat? And he says, no, I'm waiting, God's going to save me. And then pretty soon he's water's filling up and he's bailing it out. And then a helicopter comes by and drops down a ladder and says, hey, looks like you got some trouble. Can I help you out here? And nope, God's going to save me. Eventually, after several attempts at saving, he sinks and dies. And goes to heaven and meets God and says, I prayed and prayed to you. Why didn't you save me? And God said, I sent you a boat. I sent you a helicopter. I sent you this. I sent you that. I believe that if there is God in the universe, that God acts through us, that we are the consciousness and the hands of God. And again, there are many different answers to that question in this room. Last week, 2 weeks ago, I had you stand up if you believed in God or didn't believe in God or any definition of that. Several people told me I didn't know which one to stand up for, which is really exciting and something we should do more work around. But it was really fascinating. I would bet half the congregation stood for one and half stood for the other. So we have a wide diversity in this place about what we believe about God and the world and the afterlife. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can disagree with it, me to my face, and I will still be nice to you, as Brian said. There are many more questions. Thank you for submitting them. They were wonderful.